Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. Quote, each person can define his, her, or their own recovery. My faculty colleague and guest today, Dr. Peg O'Connor, has commented. A person's definition of this may change over time, which should be expected. We need to be nimble in our recovery because we are always changing, which means our needs change too. Dr. O'Connor is a professor of philosophy and gender, women, and sexuality studies at Gustavus. An expert on the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, Professor O'Connor earned her PhD in philosophy at the University of Minnesota in 1996 and began teaching at Gustavus that same year. She's authored two books on Wittgenstein and co-edited another and has received the Gustavus Scholarly Accomplished Award for her scholarly productivity and excellence. Professor O'Connor is also a leading thinker, writer, and speaker on issues of addiction and recovery, drawing on her own academic discipline and personal experience with both. She's written two well-regarded books on the subject, Life on the Rocks, Finding Meaning in Addiction and Recovery, published in 2016, and most recently, Higher and Friendly Powers, Unifying a Divided Self, published just this year in 2022. Her writing about addiction and recovery has also appeared in various newspapers, including the New York Times, as well as the magazine Psychology Today, with which, in addition to her articles there, she has a wonderfully titled blog, Philosophy Stirred, Not Shaken, with over 2 million total views. She's also spoken about the topic on television, radio, and podcasts, and in numerous presentations, both refereed and invited. A teacher as well as scholar, writer, and speaker at Gustavus, Dr. O'Connor has taught courses on Wittgenstein, great philosophers, feminist controversies, ethics, and philosophy and addiction, to name just some. I greatly admire her ability to bring philosophy to bear on addiction and recovery, and I'm delighted she could join me to talk about her story and work and the interplay between them. So, Professor O'Connor, Peg, welcome to the podcast. It's really great to have you on.
Oh, thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Yeah, we haven't actually talked in such a long time.
We have not talked in such a long time.
Yeah, it's crazy.
What a loss.
I agree. So, let's see. You're home right now. I'm in my office, and through the wonders of technology, here we are. I like to ask colleagues, basically, as I said before we started recording, how's the pandemic been treating you as a professor? I like to kind of hear what my colleagues have been going through, the good, bad, and the ugly. What's it been like for you?
Well, I continue to teach remotely, and I had fully expected that that would come to an end and that I would be back in person this fall semester, but life intervened and COVID numbers went up. But I will be heading back to Minnesota in early January, everyone's favorite time to travel to Minnesota. And teaching online has kicked my butt in a lot of ways. But having said that, I think it has also presented certain opportunities as well. So most of my classes are discussion based. So you know, while I miss being in the physical classroom space with students, with Zoom breakout rooms, I can, you know, bomb in and bug them as much as I ever do in person. And I really give enormous credit to my students who have really played along so well on formerly Zoom and now we're on Google Meet, right, and who are kind of all in. And I really appreciate that about my students, that they are, you know, needing to be nimble in their learning and their work that they're doing, as do we faculty. So I guess being flexible and nimble is the leitmotif of my existence these days.
Yeah, I like those words better than resilience. I'm sick of that word.
I can't stand resilience.
Yeah, resilience.
I can't stand it. I just was at a conference talking about care. And, you know, resilience is taken now as this new virtue. It's like
virtue.
And so what we do is we say to people, we really want you to have to be so strong because there's so much crap going on in the world. But if you want to get on it, you have to be kind of super heroic in what you do, rather than saying, shouldn't we be changing the conditions under which people are living? So it's more fair and equitable and kind.
This is why I miss talking to you. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, yeah. Totally. Can't stand the word. All right. And that's another podcast, words we can't stand. Everything you just said, I want to echo. Probably like you. I mean, I really didn't do anything online, but man, I thought the students they rose to the challenge. I felt like you know, our classes in history are so much of them are discussion based. I didn't do the breakout rooms, but I just found, you know, we had good discussions. It wasn't really any different, except that they were on a flat screen, you know, and I couldn't be with them in person. And then I started using, I don't know about you, like I had never done Moodle forum post and that kind of stuff. And I'm doing some of that still. So it's just kind of interesting to see what will continue for better and, down the road. But
I mean,
still,
I do find Moodle vexing.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Vexing and grading on it. I don't grade on it. Every cuss word I know. I know a lot of cuss words.
Yeah. No, I do not. Students turn in their work, print copy. I mark them up. I return them. I do not use Moodle. I know some colleagues do. Anyway, so are you planning to come back in the, did you say you're coming back in the spring or you're not
I'm coming
sure?
back in Jan. Driving okay. back in January. Everyone's favorite time to come.
Where are you
to
at now? Soon. Where are you located? You out in?
I'm
out
in Maine.
You're in Maine. Okay.
I've been out here. I escaped here at the end of spring term in 2020. There was that little window when things seemed to be going better.
Right.
And I fully expect to come back in the fall. I mean, I didn't really pack a lot of my coursework for the fall, and numbers just kept accelerating. So I have been out here in the town of Brooklyn, Maine.
Where's that at? What's it near?
So Brooklyn is on the Blue Hill Peninsula. It's one peninsula over, so further south from Bar Harbor and Acadia.
Okay.
And Brooklyn's a sweet little town because it's where E.B. White lived.
Oh, yeah, sure. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
right.
So you can go into the local library and you can see some of the original Garth Williams drawings from Stuart Little just hanging there.
That's
and
awesome.
He donated his entire library, E.B. White did when he died. So you can check out a book and, you know, there's E.B. White's name written right in there in his own hand. So it's pretty cool. It's a great little town.
That's neat. Yeah, I've been to a lot of parts of Maine, but not there. That's cool. I came back last fall and then was on leave in the spring. And, you know, last fall was really felt good to be back. I was a little nervous, even with all the vaccinations, but still, we'll see. I don't know. And I'm still, you know, I'm wondering. I'm not always wearing a mask the way I should anymore. I don't know what's happened to me, but it is what it is. So hopefully we'll get through it. I'm amazed, by the way. I did some looking at when all this started, what was going on at Gustavus during the influenza pandemic, you know, in 1918.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
But you know what was going on? I mean, the main thing was, you know, hey, it's messing with our football team schedule. I mean, that was like the main.
No.
I mean, that's a great quote. It's a great quote. I mean, no sense of, I'm kind of exaggerating a bit, but, you know, basically, you know what I mean? Classes were going on. I mean, it's really kind of amazing to read that in the student newspaper of the day.
All hanging out in Old Maine.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, there you go. Your neck of the woods here. Well, so back you come in the spring. Let's talk about you. I mean, you. I didn't say it in the intro, but you attended a liberal arts college. Tell us a little bit first about where you grew up.
So I grew up in central Massachusetts, and I am the product of 13 years of Catholic schooling. So that's one of the key things to know about me, why I seem to have virtually no respect for authority. I was high spirited as a little kid. It's funny. My mom passed away. That's not the funny part. She passed away in the fall, and I was going through a box, and I found my third grade report card. So, you know, little Peg O'Connor in third grade with Sister Julia. And it turned out that I participated well in my religion class, and then she noted that I showed Christian behavior, which, you know, knowing me now as at least – an agnostic, if not an atheist. I mean, I just kind of delighted in that.
That's so amazing.
So 13 years of Catholic school explains a lot about me.
Huh. Well, what part of Massachusetts? Where'd you grow up?
Central Mass. So it is about 20 miles just west of Concord. It's the end of one of the commuter rails. And it was a formerly thriving industrial city. We had textiles. We had shoemaking. We made guns. We made bicycles. And all of that went away in the 1970s. And, you know, it just crashed like the other big mill towns in Massachusetts, like Lowell and Lawrence. So it's fallen on hard times, maybe coming back a little bit just because housing is so expensive in Boston that the kind of push to, you know, be further out is, you know, a pretty real pressure. So you can buy some big old Victorian houses in terrible states of disrepair for not all that much money. I mean, they're money pits, but right. You know, if someone could refurbish them, they would be grand.
Yeah, if I could refurbish, I would. I still miss Massachusetts, and because I went to BU and where I met Kate. Anyway, so were both of your parents Catholic?
They're Catholic, but I describe us as habitual Catholics. Okay. We went to church before we went out to breakfast on Sundays.
Yeah, that's what we did in the Episcopal Church. That's exactly
what I did. And my dad used to call down to the local parish to find out which priest was saying which mass. But he could go for the one who had the, you know, shortest sermons. And his attitude, you know, was to maybe go on a late Saturday afternoon mass and use words to say, oh, get it out of the way. So that was the attitude. But they were going to send us to Catholic school. They had been to Catholic school.
Okay.
It's just what my kinds of people did what in Fitchburg, Massachusetts.
Yeah, that's so funny. I can remember my dad saying some Sunday mornings, okay, we're taking a flyer. We're not going to church today. You know, but yeah, church was
illegal.
was a social occasion, you know, it was then breakfast. So did both of your parents go to college as well?
My dad did. My dad got a football scholarship to St. Michael's Catholic College in Vermont, which was a Division I football school. And he suffered a traumatic brain injury his first year there, lost his scholarship, and worked in the in the school dining service for his 4 years there.
Oh my God.
And my mother did end up going to college, but her first job really was working as a flight attendant in the 1950s.
No kidding.
So this is the cool part. This is where I look at my mother and I think I absolutely respect and adore you. So my mother knew she wanted to travel and she was terrified of flying. So she chose to become a flight attendant.
Wow.
So talk about, you know, not just looking at your fear, but standing your fear down. I mean, coming right at it. And so she flew for American Airlines until she became engaged to my dad, at which point you were not allowed to be a flight attendant with American Airlines anymore. And so then she pretty much was a stay-home mom until she went back to work when I was late in elementary school and eventually became the law librarian for the Northwestern County Courthouse.
Oh, wow. That's all. Gosh, I wish I'd known your mom. I went through a whole flying thing, like a lot of boys, I guess, maybe some young girls too. I couldn't get enough about it. Hung out at O'Hare all the time. Wrote letters to the CEO of American Airlines and got all kinds of junk back in response. And I remember reading some crazy young adult today novel about a flight attendant. So that history is so amazing.
It is just so amazing. And what she said was, I was a glorified waitress wearing a suit and 3-inch high heels and getting grabbed and pinched and groped the entire time.
Constantly, isn't it?
You know, and that was during the glamorous days of flying.
That's when you dressed up in nice clothes to go flying. It's amazing.
No yoga pants.
Wow. No, not at all.
Yoga pants. Yeah. Damn the yoga pants.
Midriff. So your interest in philosophy, I mean, does that just come out of, I went to Catholic school, I have to be interested in philosophy. I mean, where does that start that early?
I don't think so. No, I think it happened. So I did go to a liberal arts undergraduate.
Right.
I was that student who didn't know what I wanted to do and wanted to do everything.
Okay.
So I started off we had a government department. We didn't have political science. We called it government, but we had a political theory track. And I really liked that. And then I took a philosophy course. Oh gosh, I think it was on philosophy of mind. And I just fell in love. I fell in love with what we read and how we read and the kinds of questions that we were asking and trying to answer and the kind of lively debate and discussion. And then I think as a junior, I read the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, who I fell in love with because I couldn't make sense of someone who said, what is your aim in philosophy? To show the fly the way out of the fly bottle. I mean, that just, he's got this other expression, you know, some things cause a mental cramp. Wittgenstein caused me and still causes me a mental cramp. So I take that same excitement that I had, say, in 1985, and Wittgenstein is still my intellectual companion on so much of the work that I continue to do, from the early work about oppression and responsibility and talking about the grounding of our moral judgments and is there such a thing as moral knowledge or moral truths. And it comes with me all through the work on addiction. So I met my intellectual traveling companion young, and I would say I recommit to him quite
regularly.
That's fantastic.
Regularly.
Yeah.
That's
it's, yeah been, it was, it's been great fun.
All this was at, I don't know if we mentioned, all this was at Wesleyan, right? In Connecticut, great liberal arts college too. So, yeah, what did he mean by that, the fly business?
What do I mean by the fly business?
And the mental cramps, I love that phrase. That I can understand.
Mental cramp is such a good one.
Yeah, that's a great phrase. Yeah.
So Wittgenstein was deeply, not just suspicious, but hostile about the way that academic philosophy was done. And he was very critical of his own early self doing philosophy. And oftentimes he said, we fail to see the ways in which we create traps or puzzle boxes that we can't get out of. And so his aim is always to dissolve philosophical problems by undermining their starting points or their assumptions and instead dissolve them. So dissolve problems rather than solve problems. So, you know, many academic philosophers were like flies just banging up against the glass wall of the bottle. And I thought, okay, there's an existential concussion for you.
Oh, that's a great phrase, too. Oh, that sounds great, man. I love that. By the way, you know, I have to remind myself this. You correct me if I'm wrong. He lives well into the he lives into the post-war period, right, or not?
He lives into 1952. Yeah, he was born in 1889.
Right before we were born, basically, I guess. I mean,
his family is fascinating. So his father was regarded as the Andrew Carnegie of Austria. Huh. But he was smart, and they came from a Jewish background one or two generations back. And his father pretty much got most of the money out well before, you know, the rise of Nazi Germany. He was reading the writing on the wall. Yeah. But his family was absolutely tortured in all kinds of ways. He had two older brothers that committed suicide or very actively put themselves in harm's way during World War I. Mm. His brother, Paul Wittgenstein, is a concert pianist. So wherever you encounter a piece written for just the left hand, Paul Wittgenstein probably commissioned that. Huh. And he had two older sisters who stayed in Germany and in effect entered somewhat of a deal with the Nazi to sign over some of their wealth so that they could stay there and not be persecuted under the Nuremberg laws.
Wow.
So it's a very complicated family. And Ludwig stayed in England. He had moved to England. He was a complicated character. But during the Second World War, he was in England trying to volunteer as he could. And during the First World War, he had served for the German forces and was in an Italian prisoner of war camp. And that's in part where he wrote his first greatest book, The Tractatus.
Wow, that's amazing.
So I say to students, you can be in a prisoner of war camp and still write.
Well, yeah, exactly. Right. No,
just because you have another paper due doesn't mean you can't write.
Exactly.
You can do it.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah. Eat every pea on your plate and write that second paper. Yeah.
That's right. Set that bar high.
Yeah, exactly. So does he come to the United States ever or not? I mean, as a teacher or?
I think he came to the United States maybe once with Norman Malcolm, who was out of Cornell. But he largely stayed in England. He lived for a while in Norway. He had a disastrous stint as a public school teacher where he was driven out of town because he was physically abusive to his students.
Oh, my God.
He's deeply, deeply troubled. Deeply, deeply troubled. Most likely not even so much a repressed homosexual, but it was clear he had relationships with at least two men. Huh. And if you know your history, you know, say, for example, what happened to the great Alan Turing.
Right.
Who, you know, thank goodness for his his coat cracking
about him.
Ability.
There was a movie with, what's his name? Benedict
Cumberbatch.
Cumberbatch. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So fascinating. I mean, have you thought of ever doing a biography or is that not something that, I mean,
there's a wonderful biography out there about Wittgenstein that I think really says it all. And there's nothing I could add to it.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a polymath.
Huh.
So in some ways he was regarded as the dumb one in his family because he wasn't all that musically inclined and his whole family was musically inclined. So Brahms was kind of the family composer, you know, they were his patrons. And his father decided that Ludwig showed some good mechanical aptitude. So he sent him off to Manchester in the early 1900s, and he was designing propulsion engines.
Oh my God.
And he just wasn't excited by it. So he got it into his head that he was just going to go visit Frege, who was the world's foremost logician at the time, because he was interested in it. And he said, you know, I went to visit Frege and he wiped the floor with me, but he got a letter of introduction from Frege to the great English philosopher Bertrand Russell. And he pretty much showed up on his doorstep.
Isn't that amazing? That's so fascinating. Wonderful. Yep. It's not like, hey, I'm going to go major in philosophy and then grow up to be a philosopher. It's a little roundabout.
It's roundabout.
Yeah.
And he was the most poorly read philosopher that there is. I don't think he really read much of anyone. He read some Kierkegaard because he was tortured. So that makes total sense that he would read a melancholic Dane who struggled his whole life with spiritual matters because Wittgenstein was tortured along those same lines. And the other person he read was William James, the great American philosopher. He thought James was an interesting philosopher and wrong in so many ways, but interesting in wrong and productive ways. And he wrote to a friend that he thought that James was so good for him because he was such a decent human being. And Wittgenstein spent his whole life believing that he was not a decent human being.
Wow. Geez, I want to go read the biography. I'll find
it. Yeah, it's a biography called The Duty of Genius by Ray Monk. When I taught the Wittgenstein seminar last year, all the students read it. He's someone you can't separate his life from his work.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it. It sounds great. Nope. William James is probably that's the one of all the philosophers in the world, one I know best, which isn't saying much, but I've always enjoyed, and his sister, Alice,
and
Henry.
Yes.
Yeah, fascinating family.
Do you know that there were two other brothers in that family?
Yes, you never hear. You've got William, you've got, Henry, right?
So the birth order is William, Henry.
Yeah. And then two others.
Garth. Robertson and Alice.
And Alice is last. Yeah. What's the book? Who wrote the great book about her? Was it Jean Strauss? A fabulous book about Alice James, who was so, bedridden, right? Neurasthenic, supposedly, blah, blah, blah. Really fascinating.
Well, the whole family was riddled.
Yeah, the whole family,
every
right.
single one of them. Yeah. But for the two brothers who got shipped off to serve in the Civil War, where Henry James Sr. strictly forbade William and, he goes on to become Henry James, a novelist, but Harry.
Right.
He forbids them from enlisting with the Union forces, but he encourages the other two brothers to go.
Yeah, I do know that from my Civil War seminar. Mm-hmm. But it's just also fascinating. Did you back up to high school? Were you able to take philosophy courses there or not?
Oh, dear God, no. It was a Catholic school.
No.
Okay. We weren't encouraged to think independently. Yeah. I mean, I fell in love with philosophy at Wesleyan.
At Wesleyan, yeah.
And then I had a horrible car accident 2 months after I graduated, and that's kind of an important turning point in my life. And I didn't know what I wanted to do, and so I was banged up for a year. And then I decided
that
I would apply to graduate school. I knew I wanted to study ethics, and I applied to a graduate program, and I got in. And I went for 3 days, and I left during orientation because I thought, "Oh my God, have I made a colossal error?" I always tell that to my students, nothing is forever. When you realize you make a mistake, rectify it quickly. Don't recommit to it. So this was in 1988 at the time. Yeah. So I go to this graduate program for 3 days during orientation. I decided.
PhD program?
No, it was an MDiv program.
MDiv. Oh, MDiv. Okay.
Which is even more bizarre. Wow. It's like a talk about setting up for failure. and I remember this is back in the day of pay phones, people. Pay phones where you plug in a quarter and then call collect. And I remember calling my parents, and my mother answered. And I said, "Mom, I made a terrible mistake. I don't belong here. This is not the program for me." And she said, "Well, Peggy, everyone's entitled to make one mistake, and you just made yours." Oh, my God. Abandoned ship. So then I worked for 2 years at a university press and publishing, which was the best thing I could have done because that would have been a real viable career for me. But I found out that I missed philosophy. So it was during that time that I did a more thorough search and identified I want to do a PhD program in philosophy and identified some programs, got rejected from most of them, but got in one where I knew I could be happy. And that's how I ended up at the University of Minnesota back in 1990.
Yeah. Where you're, you tell me your mentor's name, because I've met her. And is it Naomi?
Naomi Sheeman.
Naomi, yeah. I've met her at a dinner at one point. She, oh, yeah, Peg. I don't know. She was amazing because she was not retired when I met her. And she was an inspiration to me because I don't really want to retire yet. I'm 69. I thought, yeah, you don't have to retire when you're 70s if you're still enjoying it.
If you're still enjoying it, yeah, and if it is still bringing you energy and that you are still an effective teacher that inspires students.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
And I know you, so I know that you are the total package doing all those things.
Likewise. Well, likewise. Thank you so much. So what'd you work on there? So that was your dissertation was back to the, to me, it's a great title, Back to the Rough Ground, ! Wittgensteinian. Is that how you pronounce it?
Wittgensteinian.
Wittgensteinian moral realism. What in the heck is that about?
So Back to the Rough Ground actually is a quotation from Wittgenstein where he says that we really need to pay attention to our uses of language and not be looking for like a crystalline purity of language or linguistic structure. We need to take a look at actually what we say and do. And he argues that meaning is use. So he says, get back to the rough ground. You can walk on the rough ground. You can't walk on sheer ice is what he's alluding to there. And questions about moral realism are questions about whether there are such things as moral facts or moral truths, and that you can make descriptive statements about moral affairs and not just prescriptive statements about what you should or shouldn't do. And I chose the topic because I love Wittgenstein and I found the questions really, really animating. So I, wrote my 200-page dissertation and submitted it. And 2 weeks before my final dissertation defense, I woke up in the middle of the night and thought, oh, can we swear on this podcast?
Yes.
I thought, oh, shit, I am so wrong. Wittgenstein is not a realist at all. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. What do I do? My defense is in 2 weeks. Everybody has signed off on it. I don't want to do anything. So the day of my defense, I remind myself that I was and still play a little competitively tennis player.
Right. I know that.
I was a serve and volleyer. And I thought, I just need to go in there and serve as hard as I can and ace it. So at our defenses, we are allowed to make an opening statement. And so I went for it. I said, well, I've come to realize that I need to repudiate this central thesis. But in repudiating it, I believe my other two theses are even stronger. Talk amongst yourselves, in effect. And my committee got so busy fighting with each other that I just kind of sat back. And one person on my committee wanted to fail me outright.
Wow.
And Naomi, my dissertation director, said, oh, no, 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 no. Look at how much she's already thought and grown since she submitted this to us a month ago. This is actually what we want to see people do. And so the person who wanted to fail me, I ran into her about 10 years later. And I said, I don't know if you remember me. She said, oh, I remember you. She said, I have never been in a defense like that where someone repudiates themselves. And I said, and lives to tell the tale.
Yeah, exactly. Gets the degree too. That's amazing. I did not know that. See, this is one thing I love about doing this podcast. I learned so much about people. I knew about tennis, you and tennis. I did not know that. I don't ever recall hearing that story. That's amazing. You're brave. I probably would have just pretended, yeah, it's all right. It's all great. They clearly signed off.
I knew I couldn't defend it. So the funny thing about that, so I defended my dissertation successfully and became Dr. Peg. And I threw that dissertation on my bookshelves that moved around because I don't know if you remember, I used to be peripatetic because I was on loner offices. So I was downstairs from you and Oceanthro for a while.
Yes, and the dreaded social science building at the time,
Yep, then I moved over to Old Main and then I moved to Confer-Vickner where I remain. Yeah. And I never did a thing with that dissertation. I never did a thing with it because I realized I wasn't philosophically mature enough to answer the questions that I was asking. I knew that my questions were right and the answers were wrong, but I couldn't figure that out until I wrote a book in normative ethics. So that's the book Oppression and Responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where at the end of that book, I realized I had landed once again at the question of what is the nature of the ground for our moral judgments, that you say we feminists, we anti-racists, we want to make judgments that stick. And how do judgments stick? And I realized I was back at the very same questions of my dissertation, but now I could answer them differently. So that became my book, Morality in Our Complicated Form of Life.
That's so cool. That's the first book was, what, 2002, and the other one was 2008. The first book, by the way, was not, did it win or was nominated for an award?
It was nominated.
Yeah.
It's just an honor to be nominated.
Well, it's a huge honor to be nominated with the American Philosophical Association. Yeah. So that's cool. That's a wonderful story. That's also instructive for students, right?
Including, I think so. You know, our interests can change, and sometimes we're really interested in things, but we're not mature enough to be able to answer them well. And I think this fits with something about philosophy in general. I mean, Plato was saying that you really shouldn't be doing philosophy until you are of a certain age and certain maturation level. So, you know, this is not the stuff for the age of our college students. And I respectfully disagree with that. But you look at Immanuel Kant, who didn't start publishing until he was in his 50s.
Yeah. Well, let's pause here. Not for station identification, but for a definition. What in the hell is philosophy? What does it mean to be a philosopher?
Yeah, what does it mean to be a philosopher? I think that's a great question. So I always describe myself as having an orientation that fits well into the ancient world. So I would say Plato and Aristotle, and certainly somebody like Epictetus around 50 AD, where the questions are about, how do you care for your soul, or how do you care for your person or character? That's really the most important thing about you. And that our highest priority is the care of our person and the care of our soul, not as an individual or individualistic enterprise, but that we are always necessarily always connected to other people and to social bodies and playing certain kinds of roles as citizens, as friends, and that when we take care of those, that perhaps we have some kind of chance of living in societies where there are such things as justice and reciprocal goodwill. And, you know, I say all of that thinking about our present political climate.
Right. The election's tomorrow. We're recording.
The election is tomorrow. I think, you know, many of us are just utterly horrified by what might happen. And, you know, Greg, you and I had that conversation earlier about what does it mean? You know, democracy is at peril. And the ways in which there is such a fundamental lack of respect for the well-being of others, that there's such a fundamental lack of acknowledgement of the humanity of other people.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen, well, that's not true. I mean, historically, we have seen horrific kinds of examples of dehumanizing others, but just the—
Our lifetimes though, right? I mean, it's—
In our lifetimes, yeah that, you know, I see and I read things and I can't believe that people are saying these sorts of things publicly and getting accolades for them, and that there's just been such a fundamental tearing of the fabric of society.
Right.
So for me, philosophy is about being in the world and engaged in engaging and responsible kinds of ways, responsible to self, responsible to others, however broadly you expand that others. So, you know, in a class, my first term seminar, I'm teaching a course called The Good Life, where we're reading everyone from Lao Tzu to Buddha to William James and Montaigne and Emerson, asking these questions about what's involved in a good life. And every single one of them is saying, well, it isn't some kind of individual achievement. It's a social achievement. It's an ongoing achievement. It can be a fight. It can be a battle. But it's something that we must do. So, you know, my areas of philosophy, I'm a moral philosopher. So I'm—
Okay, go ahead.
I'm happy trafficking in prescriptions and talking about our norms and how they come to have a hold on us. How do we come to pledge allegiance to certain frameworks or certain kinds of value systems? And what I always say to my students is, I'm not going to teach you what to value. I'm not going to teach you what to think. I'm going to teach you how to think. And I'm going to challenge you to be more responsive and attentive to your moral character, figuring out what your non-negotiables are, what your principles and commitments are, what virtues would you want to be known for. And what I will say, in teaching at Gustavus now for, I don't know, 26, 27, 28 years, I've lost count, that our students want classes like that. They want to undertake these kinds of investigations because they understand what's on the line for them. And that's part of the beauty at being a mission-driven institution, as, you know, Becky Bergman's Monday Moments came out talking about being a mission-driven institution. And we, in general, encourage our students to think in those kinds of ways. And I feel like, you know, at times I feel like I just get to come along for the ride and provide some clarifying concepts and teach some important critical thinking skills and teach students how to ask good questions and teach them how to listen and respond carefully and charitably.
Yeah, and okay, I'm sitting here shaking my head vigorously up and down. Yes, yes, yes. I now realize I'm a moral philosopher, I guess, though not an expert.
Yeah,
like
why
you,
not?
Because that definition, yeah, that's a great definition that you gave a few minutes ago. And then, what a great, it's exactly about, I mean, why teach? What you just described is, for me, the joy of teaching, right? Yeah, we provide some direction, some guidance, some, you know, challenging questions, hopefully, but then off they go, right? And it's just such a pleasure to have a class like that. So, yeah, but I do like that about this kind of place.
And oh, gotcha. Go ahead. And then the delayed diffidence. Like, I had a lovely email from a student who graduated 10 years ago who said, I don't know if you remember me, but I was in this class, and then she went on to talk about something. She said, I still think about these things.
Yeah.
And now I'm in grad school, and I'm thinking about them, and I'm thinking about, this is what we talked about.
Yeah, there's nothing better.
Those are the best things ever.
Yeah, Gustavus trustee that I know, John Hallberg, says, one of his professors at the Wharton School called it, I don't know if this professor knew he was echoing W.E.B. Du Bois, but called it the psychological wages of teaching, not of whiteness, but of teaching. And there's nothing better. Moral philosophy. There we go. I'm all in on that. Now, that leads me to your work on recovery and addiction. I mean, this emphasis, is that the connection? I mean, intellectually, this emphasis on compassion and care. How do you get from, you know, Wittgenstein to, and maybe it's an easy answer, I don't know, but Wittgenstein to your current amazing, fascinating work on addiction and recovery?
So I'm very out as being a recovering alcoholic. I sobered up very early in my life. It goes back to that pivotal moment when I decided to go to my first grad school when I had that horrible car accident. I was almost killed, and I hadn't been drinking, but second question. First question was, are you going to be okay? Second question was, were you drinking? Like, hey, why do you think that about me?
How old were you? Were you in your 20s or?
Oh, yeah. I was just turning 22. Yeah,
you were young. Okay.
I was young, but I was an overachiever in my alcohol consumption, and I would have been an overachiever in more drug consumption if I had had my ways. And I made it a very intentional decision that I wanted to see how long I could go without drinking. So, yeah, as an undergraduate, I was a raging alcoholic. I wouldn't drink during season, so I was a tennis and squash player. But as soon as the seasons were over, I was off and running again. And even as a raging alcoholic, though, I was always a worker bee, and I loved my studies, but I couldn't get out of my own way, and I couldn't quit while I was in college. And so, you know, I say that if any students are listening, I know that we have students who are trying to be in recovery, who are trying to change their relationship to various drugs, of which alcohol is one. And it's a very hard thing to do, particularly in a college, because college provides the ultimate cover.
Right.
Because, well, they're just partying. They're young. You know, we were young, dumb, and stupid like that. We did these things. And like, yeah, and some of us did them very differently. So for a very long time, my identity as a recovering alcoholic, my life in recovery, sobriety, was largely cordoned off from my work and cordoned off from my life in general. I just treated it as a fact of the matter about me. But then when I had been sober about 20 years, so it's 35 years now, when I'd been sober about 20 years, I realized I needed to do some things differently with my sobriety because I felt similar to some of the ways that I had when I was drinking, disconnected, kind of running on an autopilot. I felt really alienated from myself. And so I decided to go to a few AA meetings, which AA has never been a good program for me. A lot of it had to do with the God language. But I realized that I needed to change my relationship to myself, that I wasn't, to go back to my earlier discussion about what's philosophy about, I wasn't taking good care of my person and of my soul by not putting my recovery a little more front and center. So that became a focus in my work. I thought, you know, I really do think philosophy helped me to get and stay sober because I had so many concepts that I could make use of. I could talk about how having the right friends makes me a better person. I could talk about self-knowledge. I could talk about self-forgiveness from a philosophical perspective, but now how was I going to live it? And that really changed the course of my work, both the subject matter, but also the people that I write for. So it was at that point that I made an intentional decision to write more for the general public, to write more for people who might encounter my readings somewhere like Psychology Today, or I had a good fortune to work with Peter Catapano at the New York Times when they had the Stone.
Yeah, it was great. Your stuff is fantastic.
Philosophy. Yeah. Yep. And, yep. And he got what I was trying to do, and he was a lovely editor for me. And I just decided that philosophy has so much to offer people. I can help to translate philosophy into, I can calibrate my language so that it is accessible to other people. And I want other people to be able to have these concepts that were so helpful to me. So, you know, that's what resulted in my wanting to chair the Nobel Conference on Addiction back in 2015.
Right.
And that was a great turning point for me. I love so many things about that conference. But if I had my way, I would change the title. I had named it Addiction, an Equal Opportunity Condition. and I would change that title now because it's not. It's equal opportunity only in a negative sense, that no one is immune from it.
Right.
But when we look at social determinants of health, when we look at patterns of structural oppression, racism and sexism, when you look at patterns of violence, you see that certain populations are far more vulnerable.
Exactly. And we see that with the plague, the current plague, right?
Right. COVID. So I would definitely, want to change that. But that conference brought me one of the greatest friendships that I enjoy to this day with one of the speakers, Owen Flanagan, another philosopher, who is a dear friend. And who was very helpful to me in figuring out the second book, Higher and Friendly Powers, which is all about William James.
Yeah, I want to come to that in a minute. Let me make sure I understand and listeners understand. You became sober not by initially attending AA meetings, or you just sort of made a decision. I mean, you just decided. I mean, that's it. I'm going. How did you do it?
It wasn't like that. And it turns out what I did was very Jamesian. So this is what I pretty much said to myself. So I knew that I had stopped and started drinking multiple times, starting in high school. I mean, my drinking career took off my first year of high school. And I almost got expelled from high school. I was drunk at a school dance, and rewind when I said I went to Catholic school, and I was really drunk at a school dance, and one of the nuns was chaperoning. And the last thing I remember saying before I went into a blackout was, "And your clothes are ugly too." So Monday over the intercom at St. Bernard Central Catholic High School came the announcement over the whole school, Margaret O'Connor to the Dean of Discipline's office now. So, you know, my goose was cooked.
Wow. Oh my God.
And I only got suspended. I didn't get expelled. Where was I going?
Now I want to ask you something. What was it about the alcohol? I mean, why were you drinking? Is that a question you can even answer or reflect on?
Oh, sure. Why was I drinking? Why wasn't I drinking?
Yeah.
No. So this was in the early 1980s. And I had the sense that I was different. I had a sense that, wait a minute, I don't like boys. I think I like girls. Oh my God, am I a homosexual? Which in a Catholic context, and believe me, I said it like that because that's how the nuns and priests would say it. I thought, oh my God, I am this, I am deviant. I am deviant. A sinner.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to hell.
Yeah.
And so I felt so awkward around all of my friends that having a couple of drinks would loosen me up. And then I felt like I would fit in. And that worked for a while, except then my drinking really took off. And suddenly I had a double source of shame that I was queer, was another word that was before it was, you know, reclaimed and refurbished. I was queer. And I was also drinking differently from my friends. So, I mean, I drank myself out of friendship circles. Mm-hmm. So that kind of double shame of that, shame is an incredible accelerant on any kind of drug use.
Yeah. And then the accident on top of all
and
that.
And then the accident actually turned out to be a very good thing. I described it as the accident that saved my life. Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. That's how we got here.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, exactly. That's how we got here. Yeah, that's how I was asking.
I'm in the hospital, and I've had a severe concussion, which, of course, I worry about the effects now, 35 years after the fact. And broken collarbone, and I am black and blue from bow to stern. You know, my left leg, I had a car door, my driver's side car door crashed in on me because a pizza delivery guy was speeding without his headlights on and T-boned me.
Oh, jeez.
And I was unconscious, and I came to as they were cutting me out of the car. Then I came to in the middle of the CAT scan, and I had the distinct thought, what the hell is my head doing in a clothes dryer? Because it's really loud, it's banging. I have no idea what's going on. And so I'm in the hospital in a world of pain, and the nurse comes with what to me seems like, well, we don't have this anymore because of COVID. But remember, you used to go to the co-op and there'd be all these free samples, free sample platters being passed.
Yes.
Except for me, it was narcotic pain.
It was narcotic painkillers. Yeah.
Exactly. And I had this thought, Betty Ford, here I come. So it's 1987. The Betty Ford Foundation has been open for what, about 5 years? The inpatient treatment center that was started by former First Lady Betty Ford. And I knew if I started taking those narcotics, I knew what I would do because I had seen my history with alcohol. And if cocaine hadn't given me absolutely debilitating headaches, I would have been, you know, happily snorting my way through college, which wouldn't have been good because it turns out I have a heart condition. So that could have, you know, remember Len Bias with the Boston Celtics?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yep. Yeah, I could have done a Len Bias.
Yeah, I sure do. Yeah.
So people who don't know that, Len Bias had a heart condition. Yep. He did cocaine and he had a massive cardiac arrest and died.
Yeah.
He was the number one draft choice of the Boston Celtics.
Yeah, down he went.
So I knew my history. And so I had that thought. And then I decided, okay, I'm going to see how long I can go without drinking again. I'm going to treat it like an experiment. I've screwed it up so many times before, but I'm just kind of curious. I'm going to see how this goes. And it's still going.
I still
treat it as an experiment because I know any day, every day, I could make a very different decision.
Right.
I could. It's well within my power. That's within my zone of control. So I'm very clear on what's in my control and what's not in my control. And so, you know, I sobered up in part because my life circumstance changed. I had graduated from college, so I didn't have that kind of cover anymore. I had decided, you know, I'm okay with being gay. I'm okay with being a lesbian. And I don't want to have that kind of craziness in my life again. And I was sober for 3 years, just kind of doing my own thing. And I moved out to Minneapolis for graduate school at the U of M. And I meet all my friends playing tennis or in dog rescue. Those are the other things to know about me. And I had met these new friends. We were playing tennis and then we went out. I don't know if this is still open. Chili's. Are there still Chili's there?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So we went out after playing some good doubles. We went out to Chili's and I'm sitting at the bar and I'm looking at all the beers on tap thinking, well, yum, yum. Nobody knows me here and I could do it. And I just happened to say to this new friend, I mean, we had known each other 2 weeks. I said, I think I'm going to have a beer. I haven't had one in 3 years. And she said, well, you haven't had one in 3 years, probably for a reason. So what makes you think it would be a good idea? And that was kind of just enough of an interruption to make me say, I'll have a Diet Coke. And I think that was a good takeaway message for me. It was a good lesson for me about the ways in which I think people who don't struggle with an addiction tend to be afraid to talk to people who struggle with addiction about their addictions.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think it's really important to acknowledge those hard times or to do what my friend did for me there. I could have made a very different choice and I didn't because she recognized something about me. She saw the import of the moment and she didn't shy away with it. And she didn't kind of have the cover of, I wouldn't want to be intrusive or anything like that. And it was a blessing.
Yeah, she had compassion for your soul, you might say.
Yeah, exactly right. So, I stayed sober and I was happy doing it, but I was happy in part because I think I so walled it off. And, anytime you wall something off, cracks start to appear.
Right.
And so, started to go to AA for a while, still didn't like it, but many of my friends now are in AA. And the quotation that you read is sort of my recognizing that I need to remain nimble in my recovery because I am always changing. So what worked for me 35 years ago, 35 months ago, 35 days ago, may need to change because I am a different person because we are always changing. We are never static. And that is the good news.
That's good news. That that quote jumped out at me because I'm a historian. And what jumped out at me is the change over time. That's literally what you say, may change over time. And then that means the context of your recovery is different, right? So, that's history. I mean, that's historical thinking there.
Yay, historical thinking. I'm a historian.
Yes, you are. I'm a moral philosopher and you're a historian.
And I'm a historian. Okay, we can swap.
We're both humanists, right? I mean, everything you said about moral philosophy and teaching, that those are the humanities.
Yes.
I did not know all of that about you. It's really, really amazing. And thank God you're okay, both from the crash and from the alcohol as well. So what is also cool, the other thing I'm thinking here that I guess I hadn't really thought of is the way in which the drinking, the addiction and your work, your academic work, they're two separate things. And now they come together in really, I think, powerful and interesting, and for people in addiction or recovery, interesting, helpful ways. Tell us a little bit, you've kind of touched on all of this, not kind of, you have, but if you had to sort of give us the pitch for how does a philosophical lens help someone in recovery or help someone deal with an addiction? What is it about philosophy?
Well, I think that addiction oftentimes very much is a cause and consequence of myriad forms of suffering. Mm-hmm. And, Nietzsche said, what makes us unique isn't the fact that we suffer, but what makes us unique is how we can transform that suffering or transform the meaning of that suffering. And I think that that's one of the most important insights that philosophy has to offer, is that we can transform our suffering and we can change the meaning and values that we assign to what it is and how we're doing. And the other way that I think philosophy is really helpful is, so everything I write is really about me. So any book I've written, any piece of blog I've published, it's like, you just got to scratch the surface. Of, look, there's Peg airing it all out there in public. Woohoo! I really understand addiction to be about losing yourself. You become lost to yourself. And I've now been really thinking about the ways in which there's different kinds of suffering. There's the suffering of having a self and losing it. That's a certain kind of suffering. So you see that with addiction. Maybe somebody who said, I traded away my family.
Right.
I lost work that was so important to me. I've lost myself. I've lost those pieces of myself.
Yeah.
And I can never get it back, or I can get it back. But lately I've been thinking about what is it like never really to have a self to lose? So a lot of what I've been thinking about, and I'm teaching a course in the spring on philosophy and trauma. Mm. I've been thinking about the ways that people who are exposed to various forms of trauma and suffering, particularly as young children, never fully develop a self, that they are developmentally interrupted in all kinds of ways. And Bessel van der Kolk, he wrote that wonderful book, The Body Keeps a Score. He works a lot with traumatized children. And he says, the diagnosis of PTSD is actually the wrong diagnosis. We need to talk about developmental trauma disorder. Mm. And I think about the suffering that comes from never having had a full self to lose, and you don't even know it.
You see the
effects of it, but you can't even recognize what it is. So one of the things that is so clear is that young people, children who experience, you know, the ACEs score, the adverse childhood experiences, when you take a look at, there's a direct correlation. I'll say correlation, not causation, because I would never, as a philosopher, want to confuse those. But really, I think it's causation.
Thank you.
Thank you. That the number of experiences, adverse experiences that a child has directly correlates to increased risks of addiction. And so here are kids who have never fully been able to develop certain kinds of critical thinking skills, never able to develop self-soothing techniques, never able to develop the kind of social skills that might enable them, you know, to find help, find other ways of being in the world. So, you know, the self they have is already so fractured, and that parts of it, not even that they lost it, but they never really had them.
Never really had it. It's a big difference.
Never really had them.
Huge difference.
So I'm really excited to be exploring that in the spring courses, in the spring this semester. And I've already had about 3 students write to me saying, are you going to cover this? I'm really interested in this. And so for me, you know, this is a very roundabout way to saying, I think addiction is a kind of losing oneself.
Yeah, I really like that. I mean, that makes sense to me.
So Kierkegaard, in The Sickness Unto Death, I have this as an epigraph. He says, the greatest hazard of all, losing the self, can occur very quietly in the world as if it were nothing at all. No other loss can occur so quietly. Any loss, an arm, a leg, $5, a wife, is sure to be noticed. But we don't notice when we lose ourselves. And I think of recovery as getting a self, making a new self, recovering an old self, creating a new self. What? Welding together, creating a composite of new parts of self and old parts of self that you fought really hard for. That is a very active kind of engagement with yourself.
Yes.
And therefore, with the world and with others in your life, to go back to that initial definition of moral philosophy.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, totally. And it makes a lot of sense. And I love what you just said. I love the emphasis. You know, it doesn't have to be just, here's this old self back there, all intact. I just have to go get it. Mm-mm. But no, it's this dynamic process. It's you might be creating new selves.
Exactly. Plural, you're selving. Right?
You're selving. Yeah. It sounds Yiddish. You're selving.
Don't selve.
What's wrong with you selving? Yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense. Now, is this in the newest book, which I do want to talk about, Higher? You mentioned it's about William James. Is that Higher and Friendly Powers?
Higher and Friendly Powers is about William James. Yep.
Okay. Now, is that related to your work on addiction and recovery as well or not?
Yes, it is, because just a little bit of Alcoholics Anonymous history.
Okay.
That Alcoholics Anonymous was founded in the 1930s by this one gentleman, Bill Wilson, and a couple of other guys. And the term higher power is in AA, and it is very much described as being like a providential God. So the idea is, if you've got a struggle with alcohol, that you need to turn your will and life over to the care of God and have God remove all those defects of character, and that really what you need to do is stand out of the way and just follow God's plans and everything will be okay. That was the reason why AA didn't work for me. I was like, I couldn't square myself with that God.
Yeah, it wouldn't work for me either.
But I had been reading a history of AA. I ended up getting a fellowship at the Hazelden Foundation up in Center City, which is
Thank you for that. Oh, sorry. That was in my original introduction. I don't know how I left that out. Yes.
So I read a reference where Bill Wilson regarded William James as a co-founder of AA. And I thought, well, that's kind of weird, because James had been dead for 25 years before Bill Wilson had his, you know, experience and decided to stop drinking and formed AA. So I wanted to uncover what the deal was there. So I knew that AA had some of the very early papers about the founding of AA. So I wanted to go digging to find out what was the influence.
Yeah,
so this book, Higher and Friendly Powers, the original expression from James was oftentimes in the plural. And while he did make reference to what we Christians call God, he included all these other things as higher powers, ideals from, say, Ralph Waldo Emerson, transcendent ideals of beauty and truth. human decency, moral principles, a sense of something else, an expansive self, even your own better self. Any of those, so long as it's large enough to take the next step, can help people to change in really radical kinds of ways. So here's the thing about William James and his family. We mentioned that he had two younger brothers. His brother Bob was what we would call now a raging alcoholic, and he spent most of his adult life in and out of, again, terms of the times, asylums for
asylums,
the inebriate.
Asylums, yeah, exactly, yeah.
For the inebriate. Yeah. And William James was his closest brother, both in a sense of affinity and in sense of geographic location. And just so you know, Alice James hated her brother Bob so much that when she found out he was moving back to the Boston-Cambridge area, that's how she ended up moving to England to be closer to her brother Henry. She was getting away from her brother Bob, which is interesting when you think about it.
Yes, it is.
So William James knew the suffering of alcoholism. You know, he himself wasn't, but his father had struggled. His brother struggled.
He knew it firsthand. Yeah, I mean,
he knew it firsthand. And yeah. William James struggled with his own, what we'd call mental health. So too did Alice. So too did Henry. Were they all at various times contemplated suicide? Were they very physically fragile, psychologically fragile? And William James was talking about the possibility of great change and alleviating suffering. And so Bill Wilson adopted some of James's terms, but got them really pretty wrong. So this book, Higher and Friendly Powers, has a kind of dual mission. One is to, well, you're a historian, I'm a philosopher. We like views represented correctly. So it's a mild corrective, but more than that, it's meant as a resource for anyone struggling with addiction and recovery to see all that William James has to offer, because he was such a astute observer of humanity and human nature, and particularly human suffering, because he himself and his family did. And he's a wonderful tour guide to how life can be different when someone fundamentally changes themselves so that they're in the world in new ways. They are reborn, regenerated, and rejuvenated. So I just wanted to make William James available to people like me. And if this book helps people who struggle with the notion of God, but AA is the only game in town for them, it's meant as a way to give more ways to think about higher powers than just a Christian-centric God. So as I said, every book is written for me. This book was written for people like me who could never square themselves with that notion of God. And it wasn't because we were constitutionally incapable or we were fundamentally dishonest. It's just those spiritual beliefs don't work for us.
Yeah.
So here are some other ones that might.
That's just fantastic. I mean, you're not reducing, I don't want to reduce William James to kind of self-help, but it's incredible to imagine. I mean, this is not the William James, how I, you know, learned about William James, right? In the context of recovery. And I wonder, so this book is really pretty new, right? It's just this year.
Yeah, it came out at the end of August.
Okay. Have you had any, I don't know, pushback reactions from AA itself at all, or
no, quite the contrary. So, you know, I've had the good fortune of being a speaker at some AA meetings. I mean, that's one of the great things about what Zoom has done for AA. I did an AA meeting that was housed out of Berlin, English speaking, and there were 179 people there, and many of them identified what country they were from, and let's just say it was pretty good representation from around the world. No pushback, because I think that many people in recovery, one of the slogans of AA, and it's always driven me nuts, is keep it simple. And I find that people struggling with addiction recovery are anything but simple, and that we ask a lot of philosophical questions. I've always said I find people struggling with addiction to be some of the most philosophical people I've ever met.
That's a great point.
I would include, every American Philosophical Association conference I go to that, I can have as good philosophical engagement with a group of drunks sitting in a dank basement as I can at the Westin in the Regency Ballroom. And I have not had any pushback because I issue an invitation to people who love AA to learn more about the person that Bill Wilson regarded as co-founder of AA.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. It's fantastic. Congrats on the book. Bill Wilson is really, I mean, he got William James wrong, you said, but he's consciously drawing on James. I mean, is he reading James?
He read James. Yeah. Okay. So the story goes, so here was Bill Wilson. He was a failed businessman. He was living with his in-laws. He was out of money, but he had some wealthy friends. He had a brother-in-law that had a fair amount of money. And the brother-in-law paid for him to go one more time to the town's hospital, which was an asylum for the inebriate, drying out. And as much as a failure as he was also really arrogant and had a very healthy belief in his ability to do anything, except this one thing, he could never get sober. Hmm. So the story that he tells, and this is part mythology, because I think any program needs a mythology.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So it's part mythology here, but the story that gets told is he's drying out, he's detoxing. And I'll just tell people that detoxifying from alcohol is, you know, withdrawing from alcohol is the one that can actually kill you. You can die during this process. And they also used belladonna to treat alcohol withdrawal. So you can hallucinate when you are detoxing like this, and belladonna can cause hallucination. So 2 points of facts there. So he's there screaming, you know, if there's a God, show yourself. I'm willing to do anything. I mean, come on, bring it on. Mm. And he said, suddenly he feels this gust of spirit and his desire to drink is lifted from him. And so he's ebullient. And then shortly after, he thinks, oh, Jesus, I'm losing my mind. I'm going crazy here. So a friend gave him William James's The Varieties of Religious Experience, yes, which was a series of lectures that got published in 1902.
I'm sorry, I started with William James way back when, yeah.
Way back when.
Some professor assigned it to us, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so Bill Wilson read it, and there was a group called the Oxford Group that read James. That was also a group for nice kind of Protestant men who were drinking too much. And so William James was in the air for Bill Wilson and the other early founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this notion of higher power really resonated with them. What Bill Wilson got really right, a couple of things. One is the importance of individual stories without an expert standing in judgment of them. So Varieties, James, is just chock-a-block with first-person stories of intense spiritual experiences, including 4 or 5 of drunk individuals or individuals struggling with carnal mirth. So sex addiction, what we'd say right now. So those really caught Bill Wilson's attention. And he really gets it right about what life can look like when drugs and alcohol aren't burning at your, what he calls your habitual center of personal energy. You know, that you've got a newfound freedom. You are free from all these kinds of dramas of offense and repentance and repair and repeat. And, right, you know, all these crazy thoughts, he says, are broken like bubbles and severed like cobwebs. Wow. So it's just beautiful, beautiful language. So the other part of this book isn't just saying, you know, Bill Wilson got all this wrong. Here's what he got right.
Yeah.
But know that you don't need a God to make all these changes in you. You've already got that power within you. You can just harness it. You can author your own conversion. You can author your own transformation. You can do it. And, you know, James describes having faith as just, it's a willingness to live on a possibility or a maybe where the results are uncertified in advance, but you kind of say, well, what if? And that's what I realized I did 22 years old in the hospital bed saying, what if every day I decide I'm not going to drink today? It was a big what if.
Yeah.
It was faith, not in a providential God, but he says your belief in something can help make that belief into fact. So my belief that I could go 24 hours a day helped to make the fact that I went 24 hours a day, and now it's 24 times however many days.
It's wonderful. It's fascinating. And I'm kind of riffing here, but I mean, so the individual doesn't need an expert to tell their story. And for some people, for some people, that expert could be God, maybe, or they feel they need God. But no, you know, William James, you're saying no, not necessarily. I want to read the book.
You can have that voice inside of you.
Exactly.
I know who struggles with addiction. You know, I had this little voice inside me from the time I was about 15, you know, whisper shouting, "You have a problem." And so to learn how to trust that voice too, because I think one of the things that addiction does as it develops is it completely saps your self-trust. And I think that's one of the greatest gifts of recovery is learning how to trust yourself again, because you show yourself to be reliable and you can become a reliable reporter on your own self.
You can have confidence. You can have confidence in yourself. Yeah. Oh, man. Fascinating. Honest to God. And I just, again, I really do admire how you've taken that. How you've taken your academic discipline, your academic studies, and applied it to addiction and recovery. Partly I admire you for doing that, because I think, and you were talking about writing for a general audience, I just think it's so important to do that as a historian too.
Yes,
to think
absolutely.
About how to bring, I mean, how to bring history to a public, you know, to how to write for a general audience, how to speak to a general audience about history, how to make history illuminate the present in profoundly useful ways. Anyway, it's really great. I love talking to you about all this. In the minutes remaining, I'm going to ask you to make a defense of the liberal arts. You're a product of a liberal arts. I mean, you're a walking defense of it, but for people who don't know you, I mean, why? You know, we both know, right? The liberal arts colleges are first of all, I'm not sure their heyday may have passed. Let's hope not. But I mean, they were never the norm, right? Most college kids don't go to a liberal arts college. What is it about a liberal arts college and the liberal arts experience that is worth defending, do you think?
I think the liberal arts, and particularly certain disciplines within them, because I think, you know, we talk about the liberal arts and we think, oh, that's what happens in the humanities classes.
Yes.
Right? The sciences, they're the STEMs, and then all the liberal arts education is supposed to happen in
all that soft stuff. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Which I think a liberal arts college like Gustavus puts them right next to each other and says, these things happen within every single discipline. There are no liberal arts perspectives that, or liberal arts courses, that every course in our college catalog is a liberal arts college. And so, you know, I always think about the ways that, say, philosophy, for example, we have really good numbers when it comes to placing students in medical school.
Yep.
And I think I want students who are going to become physicians to already be asking ethical kinds of questions, or to be looking at questions of meaning and value, and never just reducing something to a physical problem, or never reducing a person to a set of organs and other kinds of things. And, you know, the liberal arts education is meant to help people transform people and stand in relationship with others and for others, and to always be active and engaged, and to see ourselves as having fundamental responsibilities. And the thing about responsibility is that responsibility sometimes looks backwards, but responsibility is always looking forward, and responsibility always runs in multiple directions. And I think that a liberal arts education reveals some of those directions and how they run, and then how to meet our responsibilities. I think that's actually the most crucial thing that a liberal arts college does. We show how to meet.
All well said. And you remind me that one of my doctors, I was at the Mankato Clinic. I've told many students about this. One day in the exam, you know, we were talking about, he wanted to know what history majors, he's now passed away, unfortunately, what history majors went on to do. And so then I said, you know, Dr. Wheeler, what was your major? And he kind of, you know, I don't know if he literally went, shh, but, you know, philosophy at the University University of Minnesota. And I just loved it. I thought, oh, man, this is fantastic. It's great. I think everything you just said about, you know, again, I didn't attend a liberal arts college. You did. My wife, Kate, attended Bard. But it's just in my head what I always wanted to it's the kind of place I wanted to be at for all the reasons you just said.
And that's what you do for all of your students, right? I mean, that's the best. That's the best outcome.
Yeah, that's what we do.
That's what we do.
I had a high school teacher who was still around, still influential on so many of us, who was really doing that in high school, and I'm so grateful for that. And just to be able to, as you said, to understand that responsibilities, there are responsibilities, but they don't run in one direction, right? And to figure out how to meet those, and to figure out how to be, you keep saying, right? It's moral philosophy again, I guess, in relation to others. In a caring way, in a compassionate way. Let's hope we have more of that in the days ahead, in the weeks ahead.
Please, we'll see. Yeah, from your lips to the universe's ears.
Yeah, we shall see. So this is, gosh, it's been fun. Thank you so much. Highly stimulating.
Thanks, Greg. How great was this? Thank you for
appreciate
having me, Peg. The conversation. Wow.
But it's a pleasure. And you know, this is another thing I thought. I mean, I was kind of naive, you know, and I thought, oh, but I'll teach at a college and well, this is all we'll do. We'll teach and just talk this way. Not quite. There's lots of other stuff going on.
Always more stuff. I mean, yeah,
this is a pleasure. Yeah, this is the best part. So thank you so much. Congratulations on the book and take good care. See you around the proverbial water cooler.
Sounds good. Thanks, Greg. Right.
Bye-bye. See ya.
Bye.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing. Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.